Call Back the Past.
Hello, Mister. How goes it by you? Oh, by me it's fine, thank you. Please give me number 1675 Central. And say, be as quick as you like. And as quick as you don't like, if you like. What? What's my hurry? Well, the hurry is this. Number 1675 is the Widow Levinsky's number. Say, and I got a fine proposition to make to her. I'm going to propose matrimony to her. You see, it's a matrimony to me. I need it. And the widow, she weighs 250 pounds, bless her.
Comedian Joe Heyman, billed as the original Cohen, recorded in 1916. War One continued in 1916. Major battles, Verdun, the Somme, and Ypres, also Delville Wood, where the South Africans distinguished themselves. It was also here that tanks were used for the first time. British General Haig's exposition of an offensive campaign, spoken by George Rylands.
The principle of an offensive campaign during the summer of 1916 had already been decided on by all the Allies. In view of the situation in the various theatres of war, it was eventually agreed between General Joffre and myself that the combined French and British offensive should not be postponed beyond the end of June 1916. The object of the offensive was threefold. One, to relieve the pressure on Verdun. Two, to assist our allies in other theatres of war by stopping any further transfer of German troops from the Western Front. Three, to wear down the strength of the forces opposed to us. The enemy's position to be attacked was of a very formidable character, situated on a high, undulating tract of ground, which rises to more than 500 feet above sea level, and forms the watershed between the Somme on the one side and the rivers of southwestern Belgium on the other.
General Smuts led South African forces in a successful campaign in German West Africa, while the British took a beating on the southern front, notably at Gallipoli, where they incurred heavy losses. Italy entered the war against Germany in 1916, as did Romania. And born in 1916, this famous marching song.
Pack all your troubles in your old kit bag and pile, pile, pile. While you've a lucifer to light your bag, pile, boy, that's a pile. What are you for worrying? It never was worthwhile. Oh, pack.
The theatre of 1916 provided Eugene O'Neill's Bound East, John Galsworthy's Justice, and He Who Gets Slapped by Leonid Andreev. And very popular was actor William Gillett in his portrayal of Conan Doyle's famous detective, Sherlock Holmes.
Now, Watson, Watson, how perfectly absurd of you. Absurd to come standing in here, fairly reeking with the odor of the uniform, and with the black mark of nitred and silver on the forefinger of your right hand, and ask me how I know.
Oh, of course, but how the deuce did you know? My wife was away.
Where the deuce is your second waistcoat button, and what the deuce is yesterday's boot on your doing in today's lapel, and why the deuce do you wear the expression of a born alligator?
Marvelous, Martin.
Elementary, my dear fellow, elementary.
On the musical stage, Cheech and Chow began its long run. Victor Herbert presented The Century Girl, and George Robey and Violet Lorraine sang this evergreen for the first time in The Bing Boys Are Here.
If you were the only girl in the world, and you were
we could go on loving in the same old way. I could say such wonderful things to you.
The Russian priest Rasputin, who had exercised such influence on the Russian royal family, was assassinated in 1916, a year in which Roger Casement, seeking German help for the anti-British Irish, was caught landing in Ireland after his return from Germany and executed. The famous Irish rebellion called the Easter Uprising soon followed. Leaders like Collins and Pierce defied British government agents, whom they called G-men. A veteran of the rebellion recalls...
He had a sword stick, and he had a glove which he kept an automatic revolver in. Willie and he slept at the top of the house. There was a rope ladder, a bicycle ready in case of a raid. And you got used to it. I mean, one day he and Willie were going out and the boys, so I was the only one in the house. So Pierce met me coming back up the road. He said, "Are you going to be in all the time?" I said, "Yes." "Well," says he, "if any G-man comes, draw a gun and shoot him." So I said, "Certainly, certainly, certainly." And I made great preparations to receive the G-man. I had a rifle loaded. I had an automatic revolver waiting. Even the G-man, of course, never turned up.
Irishman James Joyce published his portrait of the artist as a young man in 1916, and this book was joined in the bookshops by John Buchan's Greenmantle and J.M. Barrie's A Kiss for Cinderella. George Formby was performing at the music halls. Not the Formby with the ukulele of recent years, but his father, George Formby Sr.
My grandfather's clock was a Waterbury watch. It could live 90 days without food. With a silk hat on its head and my father's Macintosh, it was dressed up like a Piccadilly dude. It was kept in the hall till the cupboard got too small and we had no place the food for to stock. So the butter and the eggs and the little mutton legs, we kept them in my grandfather's clock. And the works of the clock through the butter melting in it sent the fingers flying round at 100 miles a minute. And Grandad with a sigh said, "I haven't time to die, so I'll put it off until the clock's repaired." It was about the best thing as he could do, you know. Very sensible man was my grandfather. He always undressed himself before he got into bed. My grandfather's clock was my mother's perambulator. Round the park in it we used to ride. There was me and Treacle Tommy, Liza Ann and Justice Hawkins, screaming Ginny and the twins all stuck inside. So Grandad, who was dead, changed his mind, got up instead. And the sight that he saw gave him a shock. For the man who brought the coal couldn't get it down the hole, so he slung it in my grandfather's clock. And we didn't need a shovel as the pendulum swung higher, for every time it swung, it knocked some coal into the fire. And at 9 o'clock, the crank used to chime a double blank. So Grandad had to knock, he couldn't go.
Rationing in Germany, England, and France was introduced in 1916, a year which also saw Zeppelin raids on Paris. The Prince of Wales, though not involved in any fighting, did several royal duties, among them the handing out of medals. The Prince refused to wear his own medals while doing so, explaining the reason in a letter to his father, King George V.
I think you know how distasteful it is to me to wear these two war decorations, having never done any fighting and having always been kept well out of danger. I feel so ashamed to wear medals which I only have because of my position, when there are so many thousands of gallant men who lead a terrible existence in the trenches and who have been in battles of the fiercest kind who have not been decorated. No doubt I look at this question from a wrong and foolish point of view, but this is the view I take.
During the year, Britain's Prime Minister H.H. Asquith resigned, leaving David Lloyd George to form a coalition government. The diminutive Welshman, during the year, visited the Welsh National Eisteddfod, and he had this to say.
Why especially should we not sing at this stage of the war? The blinds of Britain are not down yet, nor are they likely to be. The honour of Britain is not dead. Her might is not broken. Her destiny is not fulfilled. Her ideals have not been shattered by her enemies. I know war means suffering. War means sorrow. Darkness has fallen on many a devoted household. But it has been ordained that the best singer amongst the birds of Britain should give its song in the night. And according to legend, that sweet song is one of triumph over pain. There are no nightingales this side of the Severn. Providence rarely wastes its gifts. We do not need this exquisite songster in Wales. We can provide better. There is a bird in our villages that can beat the best of them.
Back the Past was devised and presented by Percy Seath and comes to you by courtesy of the Springbok Radio Preservation Society of South Africa.